The last time you were in, it was on the occasion of your last book of short stories.
That's right.
Book I admired tremendously. I don't think I knew at the time that your brother was Jeffrey. Although I had interviewed him, I probably would have made reference to that. But
a lot of people didn't know that. I think that's because we write about such different things. And you would never guess from our material, our fiction anyway, that we were brothers.
No.
He had a different upbringing and grew up really in a different family than I did. Most people, until I wrote this memoir, didn't know that Jeffrey was my brother.
Well, I did learn subsequently, I don't know, maybe a passing reference somewhere, but it's also just as well because you're the baby brother, and it's like, because you really didn't grow up together to any degree, but it'd be like kind of following at your brother's footsteps in a way, isn't it? Wouldn't it? I mean, you want your own identity as a writer.
Absolutely. That's right.
In much the same way as a son following a famous father wants to strike out and have his own identity. I would hate to be, for example, all the Hemingway children. Jack Hemingway, one of Ernest Hemingway's sons, did write a book. And it wasn't a bad little book. It was mostly about his experiences as a fly fisherman.
Uh-huh.
But we talked about this book, and we talked about the same subject. It's a little off the field in terms of brothers, of course, but he said, I wanted to write this book about my experiences. I was captured by the Nazis in World War II in France, and I escaped from a prison camp, and I had some of my own adventures, but he said, no way would I try to take on the old man. But it's good. I mean, you have your own identity, and it's, I guess it's just, as a matter of fact, I even thought your names were spelled differently
mm-hmm.
for some reason.
Yeah, most people, I think those who are aware of me as a writer were aware of me as a writer on my own, and as I say, most people didn't make the connection until I wrote this most recent book in which my brother figures as a character.
Well, let's talk about this boy's life. Of course, last time you were here, I did ask you some questions about your life, and you told me in a very sketchy way, but of course that is not the same thing as telling the way you feel or the people that you met. I was so fascinated by this memoir, I read it in a single sitting. One thing that I did want to ask you about, did you change the names of the characters at all?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Everyone except... I did not obviously change my own name, although the boy in the book, who was me, certainly changed his name often enough. I didn't change my mother's name. I didn't change my brother's name. Basically, I didn't change the names of anybody who I consulted about the book and who could recognize themselves and say, yeah, that's me. The other part of the family, I changed the names. I changed occupations. I changed the name of the town, because I didn't want to cause anyone any embarrassment by this book. They are essentially as I depict them in the book, but if they want to be identified, they can step forward and be identified. But I've decided to leave them that choice.
You mean there's no such place as Concrete?
Oh, there is. Oh no, that is a real place. They're Concrete, Washington. That's where I went to high school for a couple of years.
Well, what towns, what places did you change the names of?
The place that I lived. It's identified in the book as Chinook, Washington.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. The village I lived in.
Yeah.
I went to high school.
That's right. You commuted about 40 miles, I think.
That's 40 miles each way.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Wow.
Through mountain passes. It was actually very beautiful.
The first week.
Yeah. It was actually, I always loved the drive down from Chinook to Concord. If I could actually get up in the morning, that was the hard thing to do. But we'd be going down there through it's the most primitive wilderness, or was anyway, up there, up in the Cascade Mountains. It's probably changed like everything else since then. It's been 30 years, but the road hugged the Skagit River, and sometimes on a cliff above the river, and the mountains were wilderness. It was a wilderness area, and you'd just be on this for 40 miles and see bald eagles skimming the river. And it was an experience of, it was like being in the Urals or something in Russia. I mean, it was very wild. It was very beautiful. My home life was not a peaceful life, as I've recorded here, and it was very peaceful always on the bus because people were so tired all the time getting up so early. And I think some people talk that way about commuting when they're being honest. They like it because it's one time in the day, they don't have anybody harrying them. either at work or at home, and they can listen to the music they like and think the thoughts they want to think. And in a sense, that was what it was like for me. So I actually loved that drive down to concrete. I didn't like concrete. I didn't like the high school, but the going and coming was fine.
Of course, Dwight comes over as one of two heavies in the book. One of the heavies, of course, is the narrator. Dwight is the other major heavy. Obviously, he changed Dwight's name.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever have any fears that Dwight may be waiting around the corner one of these days after he reads this book?
Well, let him. I mean, I simply put down what he did. And I make no judgments in there, if you've noticed, on him. I don't say he was a bad man or he was this kind of a man. I simply record what he did, and it's up to the reader to make those judgments about him. But there's nothing in there that isn't true. If he recognizes himself in it, perhaps it would be good for him to recognize himself there.
But you must have, the publisher or the editors must have had some legal advice on this matter. There is such a thing as invasion of privacy, even in a true story. Isn't that true?
It's not a subject that I really want to talk much about, really.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the narrator. The boy in the book calls himself Jack. I'm not sure. This covers about, what, 5-6 years of Jack's life.
That's right.
True? Up through... I guess the first year or two where Jack goes to a private boarding school. Jack, of course, is also known as Toby. For some reason, Toby wanted to change his name to Jack.
Because of my admiration for Jack London. That was why I did it. I had been reading Jack London stories and was carried away by the visions of self-sufficiency and toughness and all the things that I wasn't. That were suggested by Jack London's characters. And so I somehow or other thought if I took that name on that I would perhaps take on some of these qualities too. And Toby seemed, especially after a girl named Toby joined my class in the fourth grade, a name of some questionable strength to me. So I wanted to get rid of that.
I'm somewhat older than you, but had I been your age growing up with you in the same class... I think we would have been two completely different people. I'm not sure I would have liked you at all. I like you now, of course, and because we can share many of the same ideas, but I'm not sure that you would have had those same ideas at the time you were growing up, the time that you depict in this boy's life. What kind of boy was Jack?
Well, I've written a whole book to talk about what kind of boy Jack was. I don't know about, it's hard to say whether one would have liked someone else at a given time. I always had plenty of friends. That was never a problem. But I was a lot of the time that other boys perhaps would have been taken up in their families, I was alone because my mother was working to support us, and my father was out of touch. He sort of we were really completely out of touch for 7 or 8 years, and during which I did not hear from him or see him. And my mother was connected to some men who I really had to kind of struggle to survive with, and so I think my life was something of a struggle for survival at an age when a lot of boys perhaps don't have to think about that, especially for a kind of the survival of my self-esteem and sense of joy in life. But I did draw that from my mother. I would hate to think for people to think that Dwight is the main character in this book, because he's certainly a kind of irritant in the book. I think that for me the experience of writing the book was to see how the solidity of a bond between two people can survive all kinds of hardships and sustain those two people over time. And so for me it's a hopeful rather than a dark book. I mean, these people did in fact kind of translate themselves out of the difficulties that they had with some cunning and ingenuity, and assume different lives than the troubled lives that the book sometimes records. There was also, I mean, the things that boys get up to. And I've had lots of people tell me, I used to do that too, and I remember that too. And obviously, for a lot of people, this book strikes a nerve, and they're at least, not just boys either, a lot of women talk about, you know, growing up as well to me. And they must recognize or resonate with some of the things that I talk about in the book, because they, you know, and they talk about how funny they found them to read them again. And I was howling with laughter a lot of the time while I was writing this book. Some of this stuff struck me as very, very funny. I mean, just the whole rites of passage that you go through when you're growing up, which it is, you know, part of this book's subject.
Yeah, and a lot of it, a lot of these pranks, and some of the dishonesty, it's not so much an intention of doing that. I think it's a childhood attempt to see how much you can get away with.
One of the things that moved me to write this book, there are many things that moved me to write this book, but one of them was I have always been very skeptical of books that romanticize childhood and movies that romanticize childhood and cast that as the golden age. Say a movie like Stand By Me, you know, these boys going, I'll never have it this good again, and they all stuck together, and this is a kind of image of the golden time in a life in which everything else is a falling away and a diminishing. And I simply don't see it that way at all. I see life as getting better and better as I grew farther and farther from childhood, because the fact of the matter is, in this country, that very myth of how wonderful it is to be a child in America, the kind of thing that Norman Rockwell would put on a post cover and that populate the situation comedies on television now and the shows that were on the radio when I was a boy. The Boy Scouts, the Boy Scout magazine, Boy's Life, were constantly suggesting to you this wonderful childhood that you were having and that you had a right to. In fact, almost nobody had it. There was no ideal childhood because it's all particular. There were childhoods lived with more or less privilege, but even those who lived privileged childhoods in terms of their money and social position had troubles of their own to deal with, as we see later on. And the disjunction or the disparity between the childhood you were being told you were supposed to be having and the one you were actually having created a sense of distance and longing all the time, this sort of romantic longing. So it's partly that the book is about, too, kind of wanting in the larger world, wanting a piece of the action that you were supposed to be having.
Incidentally, I'd like to say parenthetically that Dwight is not all bad. I mean, there are many elements of Dwight that were really quite touching. The mm-hmm. fact that he took it upon himself to show Jack how to box, and taking
absolutely.
On hunting trips, inept as he was, mm-hmm. you know, there were. I think he did try.
And
in
he
his
loved
own
his children very much too.
Yeah,
he really did.
And the children came across very well too. Now, in writing a memoir like this, obviously you reveal yourself to a vast number of people. Isn't this kind of scary?
Yes, it is. It is. The fear comes when this thing that you've been working on in the isolation of your office and your memory. You know, writers, at least most writers of my acquaintance, don't think of what they're writing as books, as things that will, you know, they don't see it as a book. It's on the page for them. It's language. Writers think, you know, work and imagine things in language. And there's something very private about that when you're writing. But when you come to let it go and you realize this is going to be a book and that you're not going to have control of this anymore and that people can say or think anything they want to about it, there's at least when you're writing fiction, you at least have one more safeguard, which is that you've had the mask of fiction in front of you. That is, at least it isn't me they're talking about. It's my characters, it's my prose or something like that. It's not me. But when you're writing something, when you're writing a memoir and you're saying, this is me, or who I used to be anyway, then judgments on the book are very hard to separate from judgments about oneself. And I've noticed that often with reviewers. I mean, it amuses me. The reviews have been very kind. But often they get the book and the person a little mixed up. And also they get the character of the child and the character of the writer who's telling the story a little mixed up sometimes, too, as if they're the same.
Are you talking about fiction now?
I'm talking about this book. So it does make you feel when you write a memoir. Absolutely, you're saying, you know.
Explain that a little bit. How do they get the writer and the boy mixed up?
Well, for example, one reviewer said, "Now here's a book." And this was a reviewer who I'm not bellyaching. This was a reviewer who liked the book very much. But he raised a question at the end. He said, you know, the reader might well ask, how can we trust a story about a boy who tells lies all the time, which this boy certainly does. In fact, he completely invents himself at the end. And it seems strange to me that this would be a real question for somebody, because if I were really interested in fabricating a boy and fabricating this story, then I would have certainly cast myself in a much better light than I did. People don't generally falsify the record to their disadvantage, and I don't think anyone could accuse me of presenting a sugar-coated portrait of myself in this book. The other thing is, my interest in the boy's inventions have to do with a present concern I have for the truth. I write to get at the truth of things. That's why one writes a memoir at all, not to blur the record further. And so the reviewer, I think, in a case like this, and I think readers might well do this too, perhaps are making a jump from the character of the boy to the character of the writer who's presenting this picture to you. And they're different. They have to be different in order for somebody to say, this is a boy who told lies and eventually used those lies to invent a character who he called himself and used that character to escape from a life that he found confining and frightening, and finally a dead end. But one presents that portrait with honesty. I mean, you know, this is not somebody looking back on his life and saying, look how brilliantly I did when I was in the ninth grade, but I did even better when I was in the 10th, and observed me taking the lead in the school play at the 11th and hauling out the notices, you know. It's not that kind of a portrait. You see what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. If you had decided to fictionalize this memoir instead, could you have done more in terms of dialogue? You could have made some of the characters heavier or lighter. You could have made Jack more sympathetic. A whole bunch of different things
you could have done. Exactly.
But you decided to, in effect, to be truthful about
it. Yes, I did.
But and, of course, you are known as a fiction writer.
Yes, that's right.
So why this departure, then? I mean, why not make this a fiction? This reads like a novel. I mean, if it hadn't been stated that this was a memoir, this could easily have been a fiction to me, and I would have enjoyed it just as much.
Is that right?
Yes.
I don't think it would be. I like it. I think it's a good memoir. I don't think myself it would be a very good novel. For example, if I were to write a novel about these same people, I would demand of myself that I understand the reasons for Dwight's brutality and callousness. I would try, not necessarily in terms of explaining him psychologically on the couch, putting the guy on the couch and giving a Freudian or explanation saying his aunts were mean to him or something like that. But in writing this, I'm thinking, okay, these people did not know, this boy who was at his mercy did not know the causes for that. He only felt the consequences of it. And that's what my duty is to record here. But as the inventor of this character, if I had invented him, I would have felt more responsibility for him in that sense, and for explaining him and extending sympathy and understanding. In fact, I felt no sympathy and I felt no understanding at those times. I felt mainly fear, and I wanted to set down the circumstances that caused me to feel that fear, which is not the way anybody ought to grow up. And there are other moves that I think I would have had I would have ended it more elaborately, I think, than I do. I would have given it a probably more hopeful, it would probably feel more hopeful at the ending, at the end of the novel, than it does at the end of a novel than it does at the end of a memoir, because this boy is looking at a lot of trouble at the end of this memoir. He's got a lot of things waiting for him, and I make that clear, however good he feels at the end. There are just different moves. It would have been more. Anyway, I think the two forms are pretty different myself.
There's a wonderful episode in this boy's life in which Jack finagles his way into a private school in the East. Can you kind of give me a little reprise?
Yes. At a certain point when my home life in this village of Chinook was becoming, for me, unbearable, I was casting about for ways to get out of this, and I happened to talk to my brother one day. Actually, it was the first time I talked to him in 6 years. I called him up. I'd heard he was at Princeton, and a student at Princeton, and I called him up and just told him, I'm miserable here. What am I going to do? He said, boy, what are you going to do? I had already been routinely altering my grades whenever I brought them home. They made it, believe it or not, they made out the report cards in pencil.
God, I wish I had gone to a school like that.
I know. Incredibly enough, they made out the report cards in pencil, and I own some pencils myself. So everybody at home thought I was getting straight A's. In fact, I was getting C's and D's. I was good in English, like guys like me are, but I didn't do anything else at all. And I had a bunch of rowdies that I ran around with, and we cut school a lot. I was in terrible standing at school. I talked to my brother, and he said, what kind of grades did you get? I said, well, I got straight A's. I told him I was an Eagle Scout, which I wasn't. I told him a lot of things about myself that weren't true. He said, well, you sound like you might be able to get a scholarship to a prep school. Why don't you try to do that? You have fantastic credentials. I told him I was a champion swimmer, which I wasn't. So he gave me the names of some prep schools, and I sent off for applications for scholarships. And when I actually got these applications, and in which they wanted official recommendations and official transcripts sent and real records of your achievement, there was nothing to say. What was I going to do? So I sort of gave up. But then a friend of mine did me a favor, and he gave me a bunch of he gave me stationery from the school office and some official transcript forms. I made up a person, basically. I wrote my own letters of recommendation, and I filled out the grades in ink, straight A's, and said wonderful things about myself. I invented a swimming team for the school, which it didn't have, and wrote a letter from the coach, and I made myself out to be the person that, in a funny way, I really thought I was. You know, when I told my brother those things about myself, at those moments, I would really believe I was that someone. I had a lot of fantasies about myself and about who I wanted to be. And at times, those fantasies were more real to me than my genuine circumstances. And this was my chance to really put, you could say, my best foot forward, which was my fantastic self. And so I wrote this up, and at one school, they found it plausible enough to give me this scholarship, and it changed my life. They brought me there and the Hill School in Pennsylvania, and they educated me. It was a great school. I didn't know anything, and the act didn't hold up very well, as you could imagine, once I got there. But I managed to hang on for 2.5 years or so, and I had wonderful teachers, and especially a wonderful English teacher. History teacher encouraged me, got me writing, reading well, and it turned out to be a lifesaver for me. They kicked me out eventually, as they had to, but it wasn't their fault. I tested them to the limit. But
where is the Hill School?
It's in Pottstown, Pennsylvania.
So these application forms, your first fiction in a way, huh?
Well, I suppose in a way you could say my first fiction was changing my name to Jack, I mean, it was funny, you know, nobody really knows why he or she is a writer, you know. When you look back over the past like I did here, and I started seeing these patterns of self-invention all through my past. And so I thought, yes, this is either a crook or a writer. This person's going to be one of the two. Well, I had the advantage of knowing he ended up being a writer, but it could have gone just as easily the other way, because I felt no scruples about that when I was young. No scruples at all.
There's something else that you mentioned in This Boy's Life, that if there had been drugs around, you would have been on drugs.
Yeah, it terrifies me, especially with my two young sons now. I feel this is the dragon that all children have to somehow get past now, and it's a terrible one. We didn't have anything like that when I was growing up. I suppose the worst thing that happened to boys when I was growing up is they'd get drunk and maybe kill themselves in a car crash. That happened to boys I knew. But not that many, one or two. But now, it's so frightening. And I know the boys that I ran around with tried everything that was there to be tried, in a way. And you do. You have this sense of immortality and invincibility when you're young. what hurts other people won't hurt you. It's just, that's just other people. And I certainly felt that way. Insane. I mean, and I imagine, to tell you the truth, I probably would have ended up taking drugs if I were young and being the way I was then.
Still, enough people of the 60s generation, 70s generation, they survived it. I mean, we're a big country.
But they didn't all survive it.
No, they didn't all survive it.
They didn't all survive it very well. I mean, there are a lot of walking wounded out there.
And it's put them far, far behind. They'll never catch up. But
right.
Enough survived it that we still have writers like, well, we have a whole generation of new writers who write about drugs, in fact,
yeah.
And somehow have beat it
yeah.
and have overcome it. I'm talking about this new wave like Jay McInerney
yeah.
and some of these people.
That's right.
This is such a touching, touching book. After your friends, acquaintances, family, after they've read this book, do they look at you any differently?
My friends and acquaintances, I think, do. I think it's something of a revelation for them because I'm not like the boy in that book anymore. But my mother and my brother both found it completely recognizable, and it corresponded very much with their own memory of those times. And since they both appear as characters in the book, I was very anxious that this should be accurate. And I gave the book to them as I was writing it. And not with the idea that I would allow them to censor it in any way, but just to confirm my sense of its accuracy and to dispute things that they thought really were distorted. And neither of them found it at all distorted. My mother had some disagreements. Like, she's funny. There was a dog that I give some treatment to in the book that my stepfather traded a rifle I had and loved, a Winchester, a very old Winchester rifle, for a hunting dog, which was supposedly going to be my dog, but actually it was his. And that dog, in my memory, was a monster. I mean, it was the ugliest dog. But my mother is very funny, because she hated the dog, too. But she remembers the dog as being very handsome. And maybe I just don't like Weimaraners or something. But that's the kind of disagreement we had. And that was really about it. And there were some chronological things. She's got a very good memory in terms of time and when things happened. She thinks I got some things flipped around in sequence. But I kind of let most of those things stand, because this is a story that memory tells me. And it's a story about identity, this story, and about discovering an identity. And the way in which our identities are formed is largely through our sense of who we are, and that is what's happened to us. Our memories tell us who we are. And so I consulted my memory mainly in this book. Then I went checking to make sure I hadn't distorted anything grossly, obviously, or hurt anyone unduly or in the book, but they seem to find it quite accurate.
Now, I just wonder how important accuracy is when you're writing a story like this,
mm-hmm.
because you are, it's an evocation of time and place and person and feeling.
That's right.
Well, Tobias Wolff, wonderful book. I could literally not put it down until I got up, I think, about 2 o'clock. I didn't get up at 2 o'clock, but I settled down around 2 o'clock, and I think about 10 o'clock that night I finished This Boy's Life.
Oh, wonderful.
It was a wonderful book. Thank you very, very much.